Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, it's the Tom Hartman Podcast, brought to you by Cameron Hughes Wine. There's a little secret that most people don't know about the highest quality wineries in the United States and how they work. They'll say, you know, as they start their year, okay, we're going to bottle, say, 5,000 bottles of wine this year. And so they overproduce for that, produce enough for maybe 6,000 bottles of wine. But, you know, they've sold 5,000, they're ready to get 5,000 out. And so that's basically all they do under their own label. And then when they're done, they've got casks of wine left over that haven't been bottled. Cameron Hughes contracts with some of the very best vineyards in America to take that essentially surplus wine. I mean, you know, it's the exact same wine you would buy in a bottle for 50, 60, 100. One of the Cameron Hughes wines I had last week, the retail price, if you knew who the brand was over $150 a bottle. Cameron Hughes buys that in bulk, bottles it, puts just a simple number. Here it is, lot 506 or lot 622, simple number on it, and you get some of the most spectacular wines at huge discounts off what you would normally pay. Cameron Hughes has been doing this since 2001, seeking out high-end wine from around the world and selling it online direct to his customers. This is not just American wines, earning Cameron Hughes Wine the number one wine brand online. It's just extraordinary stuff. I recently sampled Lot 609. This is a Cabernet Sauvignon. It was insane. It was so good. It was bold. It was rich. It had the black fruit and red licorice and crushed red rock, all these extraordinary tastes, juicy and ripe on the palate. You got to check this out. Go to chwine.com/Tom, T-H-O-M. C-H as in Cameron Hughes. That's his name. The guy who started the company and runs it. I've talked with him. He's a great guy and he's doing amazing stuff. chwine.com/THOM. Or text the word wine, W-I-N-E. Text the word wine to 511-511 and you'll get free shipping with your minimum 3-bottle order. So text wine to 511-511. Cameron Hughes Wine. Exceptional value. Extraordinary wine. Now enjoy the podcast.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
My friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Aretha Franklin died, and boy, she was part of my life. I mean, I grew up as a teenager listening to Aretha Franklin. And growing up in Michigan, I mean, the Motown sound and all that kind of stuff, it's just, wow. She died of pancreatic cancer, which is tragic and unfortunate. Nate was telling me how she actually offered to pay the bail for Angela Davis after she got busted by the FBI. But for our topics for the day and what we're going to get into today on the program, there's just a pile of news, a lot of things happening, of course. The Accountable Capitalism Act, although I want to get into this in just a moment, this is something that Elizabeth Warren is proposing, and I think it's really solid. It's a great beginning, and I want to get into some serious and consequential detail about it. And why is Turkey affecting the economic health of the planet? And I'm talking about the country, not the bird. And what does this say about capitalism? We're going to ask that question of Professor Richard Wolff. So, you know, a lot coming up today. It's going to be a fascinating day. So, Elizabeth Warren is pointing out that there were a number of changes made in our system of corporate governance back in the 1980s. These were all changes made during the Reagan administration. And, I mean, it's really amazing to think about it. I remember the 80s, and I remember many of us protesting what the Reagan administration was doing, but, you know, there wasn't much of an audience for those protests. They were like, well, yeah, you know, so what? And I think it's a really big deal that we keep in mind how consequentially Ronald Reagan changed America. Everything from taxing Social Security, you know, cutting Social Security benefits that way, to stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act, kicking off 30 years, going on 40 years now of massive consolidation of small companies being wiped out, medium companies slamming together into giant companies. And now we have literally half as many companies that are publicly traded, like on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, literally half as many companies representing more than twice as much wealth. So we have just this massive growth of giant corporations that are unimpeachable, unassailable, and have tremendous political power. They're spending billions with a B lobbying and supporting candidates around the country. It's mind-boggling what has happened. And one of the biggest things that they did that was so wrong that Reagan did was he broke the connection between companies and their employees, the connection between companies and their communities, and the connection between companies and their customers. And frankly, I think you could also make the argument that he broke the connection between companies and the institution of the business itself, that CEOs no longer cared that, hey, you know, Sunbeam is a great company. No, now it's, hey, is this a brand that we could merge with another company and I could get a big bonus for making that merger happen? That kind of thing. And the main way that they broke that connection between the people running our companies and all of the various constituencies that they historically had prior to the Reagan administration was by changing our tax law to make it possible for companies to compensate their stockholders in a major way. I mean, they were doing this before this, but they were only doing it in a fairly minor way because there were tax consequences to doing it. It cost companies money to give shares in the company to their employees. Reagan changed that to where it actually made companies money. It was a deductible expense. It increased their profits to give shares to their employees. Now, they don't give shares to their average working people, but they do give shares in lieu of compensation to their senior most executives and their CEOs. And so the consequence of that is, you know, for 30 years now, CEOs have been paid mostly in stock. And so what do? They try to do everything they can to jack up stock prices. So Trump passes a tax bill, you know, a corporate tax reform. This is part of the GOP tax scam. They called it tax reform. Really what it was cutting the top tax rate from 35% down to 22%. So more than $1 trillion there that he just cut the taxes of American corporations. Now, if that had happened prior to the Reagan era, those companies would have put that money into research and development, developing new products. They would have put it into marketing and advertising, increasing their sales. They would have put it into new sales forces. They would have put it into factories to build more products. They would have put it into wages for their workers. They might have put some of it into their communities, you know, endowing hospitals and libraries and things because they want the goodwill of the community. Or even something infrastructure-wise, helping assist with putting together, you know, local broadband systems and things. But they didn't do any of that this time. Instead, what they did, because all the executives, all the senior executives in the companies now are being paid with stock, what they did was they had the company buy back some of its own shares out of the stock market and retire them. Now, what does that do? It reduces the number of shares in circulation. Well, the value of the company stays the same. You got a $1 billion company, whether it's got 1 million shares in circulation or 500,000 shares in circulation. So if you cut the number of shares in half, what happens to the price of the stock? It doubles. Doesn't mean the company sold even one extra item. Doesn't mean that they invented one new product. Doesn't mean they did a damn thing. In fact, they might have done less than all of that, but by cutting the number of shares in the marketplace, it increases the price of the individual stocks. And if you're being paid with stock, and last year you got paid with 1,000 shares of stock that were worth $100, and this year those shares are worth $200, you just made a $100,000 profit. And because it's long-term capital gains, it's not even taxed at the highest personal income rate, it's taxed at the top 15% capital gains rate. So the executives are not only making off like bandits, by screwing the community, the customers, the employees, and the company itself, they're not only making off like bandits, but they're doing so in an environment where they're paying half the taxes that you and I pay. This is totally screwed up, right? Brought to you by Ronald Reagan and idiots like Forbes and Moore and all these guys who are, you know, these supply-siders. You know, two guys I've debated on this program in the past. So Elizabeth Warren comes along and she says, okay, we've got to change this. And I'm all in favor of this. She said, we need to require corporations that bring in over $1 billion in annual revenue to obtain a federal charter. Now, right now, if you create a corporation, unless it is a hybrid corporation that has some federal government involvement, like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting or Amtrak, and those are anomalies. But right now, the only agencies that issue corporate charters are states. So you incorporate in the states. Well, she's saying that any corporation that does more than $1 billion in business needs to also incorporate at the federal level. And that $1 billion in business, by the way, that's over 3,500 companies in the United States, would then have to have a federal charter. Now, why do you want them to have a federal charter? So you've got national standards for their behavior. And that charter would require that the executives of that corporation consider the interests of all the corporate stakeholders, the workers, the customers, the communities. Now, right now, they don't have to care about the workers. And so, you know, CEOs routinely go out of their way to screw their workers. They don't have to care about the customers. So, hey, let's import cheap junk from China rather than making something really good here in the United States. And they don't have to consider the needs of their community. Thus, again, saying to hell with our communities, to hell with the United States. Number one. Number two, give workers the power to elect at least 40% of corporate board members. Right now in Germany, if the company has over 1,000 employees, which is, you know, kind of the same category, billion-dollar companies, right now in Germany, such companies have to have 50% of their board made up of employees who are appointed by the unions. Now, this would give workers the power to elect 40%. This is not anywhere near as strong as Germany's, but it's a big step forward from where we're at right now. And they would ban corporations from making political expenditures without the approval of 75% of its directors and shareholders. So you'd have to have both the shareholder meeting, or at least a mail-in ballot, plus 75% of the board of directors. And the federal government would then have the power to pull their charters, their ability to operate a corporation, anytime they wanted if these companies didn't behave appropriately. So, of course, CNBC brings out a guy from the Cato Institute, you know, that used to be the Charles Koch Foundation, Koch founded the Economic Policy Studies think tank, which is part of the Cato Institute. They bring out this guy, Jeffrey Miron, a shill for the billionaires. And he says, this is going to be really dangerous. He says, only honest and law-abiding companies will comply, meaning it's those companies will bear the brunt of the regulatory burden. Right, this is like saying only the people who comply with the law are bearing the burden of the law. You know, I don't shoplift, so I have to deal with the burden of anti-shoplifting laws. I don't rob banks, so I have to deal with the burden of anti-bank robbery laws. It's terrible. It's overwhelming. Well, this is Elizabeth Warren's plan, and I think it's spectacular. And I encourage you to learn more about it and let people know about it. And, you know, we need to do something to fix corporate America right now. Corporate America is committed to ripping us off. I want to tell you about that and Mick Mulvaney after we come back from the break. But this is a great step forward. And I think it is also positioning Elizabeth Warren really well for a presidential run.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bob in Eureka, California. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I was wondering about the tariffs that Trump has put on, you know, everything. And who's profiting from that? What's the scam? Who's making the big money? Because there's lots of money being poured out somewhere.
Yeah, that's a great question, Bob. I would love to see somebody dig into it. I don't know the answer right off the top of my head. What I do know is that if you look at the history of tariffs, tariffs were first put into place back in the 1400s, late 1300s, early 1400s, the 14th and 15th centuries, by what were referred to then as the Low Countries, Holland principally, and parts of Belgium. And the Dutch did this and said, if you want to bring goods into Holland, you have to pay a tax. But if you want to buy goods from Holland, no tax at all. In fact, we might even subsidize them. And that turned Holland into the first real worldwide, well, at least Europe-wide, empire. I mean, the Dutch trading companies of the 14th and 15th centuries were famous. And then in the...
Wasn't that the tulips?
Well, no, this has nothing to do with the tulips. The tulips, A, they came about much later. I believe it was in the 1600s, the Seven Seas scandal or whatever it was, you know, the Dutch tulip scandal. There was a big company that they built that, that collapsed. But the only reason that that was possible was because Holland at that point in time was one of the most industrialized, one of the most wealthy countries in the world. So all kinds of average people had enough money to bid up the price of the tulips. Well, how did those people get their money? Tariffs. The Dutch government built, using tariffs, built themselves into a powerful trading empire. Then in the 14 or 1500s, and I'd have to go back and look at the year, 1527 sticks in my head, but it may be wrong. King Henry VII, the Tudor king, said that, hey, this is a great idea. And at that point in time, England was thatched huts and dirt roads. There were not even paved roads. London was a little tiny town, right? And, I mean, this was, you know, right in the middle of the Middle Ages. And Henry VII said, let's do the same thing the Dutch did. And so he put tariffs on, because the major export from England at that time was wool, raw wool. And it was being spun in France, but not in England. He put tariffs on the export of wool and on the import of finished goods. And within three generations, England had become the world's largest industrial power and trading power. So it really worked. And Alexander Hamilton looked at that in 1791 when George Washington asked him to and said, we can do the same thing here. And he read his report on manufacturers or my book, Rebooting the American Dream, which reprints his report on manufacturers. And you get it. Hamilton did that for the United States. And we became the leading industrial power in the world. Then starting in the 90s, starting really in 93, we reversed all that and started aggressively doing away with tariffs. And the result of that is that all our jobs left. So A, I agree with Trump's instinct to tariffs. I think it's an important thing. But B, your point, there appears to be a lot of the exceptions to these tariffs. They're doling them out to foreign companies. They appear to be going to either countries that Donald Trump wants to do business with and likes, not for purposes of national interest or national security, but for Trump hotels and things, and companies that are somehow linked to the Trump crime family. And I haven't seen a definitive list of this, but I see anecdotal comments constantly flying by. Bob, thanks for the call. I've been using the Muse EEG neurofeedback headband. I'm not sure that's exactly what they call it, but the website is choosemuse.com. It's a little headband you put on, just sets over your ears, sort of like a pair of glasses, only it goes across the forehead. And it actually reads your brain waves, your EEG, and feeds it back to you through a free app on your smartphone into your earphones, into your ears, as the sounds of weather. And as your brain gets more agitated, the weather gets louder. And as your brain gets calmer and more peaceful and more meditative, the weather gets softer and the waves get softer. And you start hearing little birds when you're having really cool brainwave activity that's associated with the way that good meditators do it. It's a meditation instruction tool, and meditation is such an incredible thing. It you know, helps concentration, focus, lowers blood pressure. I've been using this for about 4 or 5 months now, and I have noticed in my daily writing, because I've got a 10-book contract right now, and I'm writing so much every single day. I used to sit down to write and say, okay, I'm going to write for an hour, and half of that hour was spent with distractions. I'd think of this and think of that, and, oh, I need to check my email. Oh, I got to do this. And I would constantly distract myself and then eventually come back to it. Since I've started using the Muse, now when these distractions pop up, just like they do in my meditation, I've learned how to, just like in my meditation, say, oh, that's a distraction. I'll let go of that. I'll come back to that later. I'm going to get back to writing. And now, instead of getting 30 minutes worth of work done in an hour of sitting and writing, I'm getting 50 or 60 minutes of work done in an hour of sitting and writing. It's really extraordinary. You can learn all about it at choosemuse.com. And if you order using the code TOM, T-H-O-M, you get $30 off. So check it out. It's great. choosemuse.com. Okay, continuing with my rant about, you know, the Reagan policies were actually, most of them, put into law by Congress. But Trump is ignoring things actually put into law by Congress. For example, you know, back in the day, the Pentagon came to the lawmakers and said, you know, we've got a really serious problem. And the really serious problem is predatory loans. The former Army Chief of Staff, Raymond Odierno, he said, the Army has a lot of experience with predatory lenders, and none of it is a good experience. This is back in 2014. As a result of this, the Military Lending Act was passed. And the Military Lending Act makes it basically a crime to prey on soldiers. You can't target soldiers with crappy financial products. You can't give them documentation that is filled with fine print and they don't understand and can't read. You can't jack up interest rates on them without warning. I mean, basically, that's what the Military Lending Act does. But the subprime industry, shall we say, the parasites of the payday lending industry are ultra, super targeting military bases. I mean, you know, as early as 2005, researchers found, this is from Carl Frisch's group, AlliedProgress.org. As early as 2005, researchers found that payday lenders were disproportionately clustered in proximity to large military populations. The study also found that in states with high military populations, more than 60% of the 20 highest payday lending zip codes were associated with military installations. Now, military installations are not 60% of the American land mass, but they're 60% of where you find payday lenders. That should tell you something. A 2006 DOD study, Department of Defense study, found that predatory loans are, quote, prevalent and targeting military personnel with payday loans, car title loans, tax refund anticipation loans, and unsecured loans. Now, setting aside the fact that probably less of our money should be going to our defense contractors and more to our actual service members, or they wouldn't need, so that they wouldn't need payday loans, you know, that's kind of a separate argument. But the Department of Defense came to Congress and said, we want unambiguous price disclosures, right? No BS price disclosures of financial products, number one. Number two, federal caps against usurious rates, federal caps on interest. The ability to, you know, verification that a person actually can repay before you give them a loan. And preserving military's family's right to legal action. All four of those things are being undone right now by Mick Mulvaney, who's running the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which is in charge of enforcing the military Act. And six Republicans now on the Banking Committee are about to confirm Kathy Craninger as director of the CFPB. And, you know, Carl Frisch says, if these senators are serious about protecting our men and women in uniform from predatory lenders, they cannot support Craninger's confirmation to lead the CFPB. She will rubber stamp Mick Mulvaney's depraved decision to stop actively holding financial scammers that targets our service members and their families accountable. 49 senators have sent a letter to Mulvaney about this. I'll give you the list of Republican senators right after this, and then we'll pick up your calls. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Here are the senators, the Republican senators that you might want to contact and say, do not vote for the confirmation of Kathy Craninger as director of the CFPB. She wants to essentially take it apart. She doesn't want to enforce the law, particularly the Military Lending Act. And the senators who you should contact, this according to AlliedProgress.org, are Richard Shelby, Bob Corker, Pat Toomey, Dean Heller, Tim Scott, and Jerry Moran. They all voted for a 2013 NDAA conference report, which specifically said that the CFPB could enforce this law. And now they're on the edge of putting somebody in charge of the CFPB who doesn't want to enforce that law. And what kind of weird is that, right? So, anyhow, picking up your phone calls here on Anything Goes Summer, Jason in Chicago. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm taking advantage of the Anything Goes Summer here to be off topic. There's a stat that you commonly throw out about the value on education based on the GI Bill.
Yeah.
Back in the day, I think it was every dollar that we invested would be $5 more that we would get back
into
the economy.
It was seven by the mid-1970s, I think. Yeah.
Yes, and while I completely agree that education is very valuable, I'm afraid that that calculus no longer applies. Back in the 50s, you get a dollar would be like 1/500th of a year's education. Now it's like 1/20,000th of it. So the cost of education has spiraled so much quicker than the rest of the economy. I'm afraid that we don't get quite that great a return anymore.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. It might be more like a 2-to-1 return. Even if it's a 1-to-1 return, it still justifies the cost of covering the cost of education. But the larger point, I think, is, and I get your math here, Jason, but I think the larger point is that if we were to provide education for all, the price of education would go down. You know, once it's viewed as a public good, as a public utility, and once there's, you know, good funding for it, I mean, right now the market is fairly limited. It's limited to people who can afford to pay for it or people who are willing to throw their families into debt. I have so many friends who, in the 50s and 60s, who are probably going to retire with five or six figures in debt because they put their kids through college. Mm-hmm. And my kids have so many friends who can't get married or buy a house until they're in their 40s because they're paying off student loans. That's the other side of the equation that is ignored in your math, Jason, which is the drag on the economy and the drag on culture and society by people not even being able to start their lives because they have student loan debt, and people not being able to appropriately retire and thus spend money into the economy, which keeps the economy going, because they have student loan debt. We have extracted over $1 trillion from our economy in the form of student loan debt, something that literally did not exist 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. I mean, graduating $80,000 in debt is not losing $80,000. You're probably losing $160,000 by the time you have it all paid off.
That's right, or more.
System.
Yeah, or more, depending on the interest rate, and depending on what percentage of people don't make it and default and end up, you know, with fines and penalties, and the taxpayers then have to pick it up, and they can't declare bankruptcy and things. Even if it's not 7-to-1 anymore, even if it's not even 2-to-1 in terms of expense, it's still the right thing to do for our society. I was reading Jefferson last night, and I'm working on a book about the Supreme Court, and I was digging through his collected letters looking for his comments on the Supreme Court. And he was talking about how the solution for the problem of a dysfunctional government, he was saying, I don't think the Supreme Court should be the one that determines what's constitutional and what's not. It should be up to the executive branch to determine for the president. You know, for the president should determine for himself what's constitutional, what laws he thinks are constitutional and should sign, and what laws he thinks are unconstitutional and shouldn't sign. It should be up to Congress to determine whether the laws they're putting forward are constitutional, and their authority should stand. And he was challenged in this by one of his correspondents, one of the guys he was writing with, or, you know, writing letters back and forth with, you know, who said, well, what happens if the people make a bad decision? What happens if the people elect a bunch of, you know, a president or a bunch of elected officials who are acting in an unconstitutional way, and you don't have the power of the Supreme Court to rein them in, to say, no, this law is unconstitutional? And Jefferson's response was that we should tax every citizen $1 a year and thus pay for a national public education system that included college. I mean, it's literally, you know, this is Jefferson's letters. And this is from like 1818, as I recall. It was after he left the White House. And it just was like, whoa, am I really reading this? Thomas Jefferson calling for national public education. Well, of course he was. He started the University of Virginia as a free school. So his solution to the problems of dysfunctional democracy was more education. And modern day Republicans have completely abandoned that. They've gone in the complete opposite direction and said, no, let's make it harder for people to get an education. Even an elementary school education, let's make it harder. And let's maintain this local property tax-based system for funding our public schools, because it makes, you know, public schools in poor neighborhoods poor and crappy, and it locks in poverty. And, you know, making sure that public schools in high-end, affluent, top 5% areas are really, really nice, because that locks in the upper middle class. And finally, Mark Penn, in his book Microtrends, points out that, yes, the middle class is shrinking, and, yes, some of that is because people are falling out of the middle class into the lower working class, into the working poor, but more people are falling out of the middle class into the upper middle class because of college education. So we just don't pay anywhere near enough attention to this stuff. Jason, have you said what you wanted to say?
Yes, I did. Thank
okay.
you so much, Doug.
Thanks a lot, Jason. Good talking with you.
Bye.
Mario in Miami, Florida, watching us on YouTube. Hey, Mario, what's up?
Hey, Tom, man, you are a breath of fresh air.
What's up?
I love your show. I've been listening to your all the old gang on Air America, Stephanie Miller and all the rest of them. But I just love you I listen to you all the time. Anytime I get a chance, I tune you in. But no, the thing I wanted to say was the industrial age is killing the earth.
Yes.
If you go 400 years back, before, I don't know how many years, 400, 500, I don't know what it is, but everything was organic. There was no artificial anything. It was all organic. And every step we take into the future is making nuclear bombs, and there's like over 1,000 industrial chemicals they've never tested for cancer.
It's 80,000.
Yeah.
80,000.
We're killing ourselves. By the smarter we get, we're killing ourselves.
Yeah. No, it's your point is really well taken. And by the way, it's also, I think, a function of population, but certainly a function of technology. Prior to the agricultural revolution, 10,000 years ago, there averaged probably between 25 and 100 million humans on Earth during the 100,000 years prior to that, at any given time.
Right.
After the agricultural revolution, we went up to a population, a worldwide population of around 250 million. That was at the time of Jesus. From there to the first billion took 2,000 years. We hit our first billion in 1800. Well, it took 1800 years. Our first 1 billion people was in 1800. The next billion people took only 130 years, 1930. When Franklin Roosevelt was sworn into office, there were only 2 billion people on Earth. The third billion took only 30 years, 1960. When Jack Kennedy was sworn in, there were only 3 billion people on Earth. The fourth billion took, as I recall, 17 years, 1977. The fifth billion took 13 years, 1984. The sixth billion, down to 12 years in the 1990s, I think it was 91. And now we're pushing 7 billion. We're over 7 billion. And that is producing enormous pressure.
It's not just the people. It's our technology is killing them.
No, but my point is that kind of demand for food has led to the use of technology to produce food in excess of what our food-bearing areas typically could provide.
It's not just food. It's cars. It's airplanes. It's everything. Plastics.
Yeah,
everything that we invent is killing us.
Yeah, we're digging all this stuff up from the earth, which is... By the way, Wayne, are you suggesting, is this a Luddite call to action that we should abandon technology?
You know, everybody, all they need is a house to live in, a bed to sleep in, and some food to eat. That's all
they need. But they died when cholera or yellow fever came around.
People lived back then. They figured out, your human body figured out, and plus there was guys that, shamans and stuff, they knew how to give you a certain herb or something to help you survive. It's like, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, but if I've got pneumonia, I'd rather take an antibiotic than an herb.
But would you sacrifice the earth just so that you could live? I would.
Well, this is the big question, Wayne. Is it possible...
I don't care about an antibiotic.
Is it possible to maintain the integrity of the planet? And that argument has been largely lost in the last century, but is it possible to regain the integrity of the planet and maintain modern technology? And I think that the fact that we are, number one, becoming more ecologically aware as our global warming is melting our planet down, on the one hand, and on the other hand, that we're moving away from fossil fuels. Right, this year, the planet is generating more solar electricity and wind electricity, more green power, not just hydro, but just solar and wind, more solar and wind power than the amount of electricity that the entire United States consumes. So this is huge, and this is spreading around the world really rapidly. And I think as we get off a fossil fuel economy, the next step should be getting off an extraction economy. And I frankly think we can do it. I'm a little more sanguine about this. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report underwritten by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. On the line with us is the author of Sideswiped, Bob Ney. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Hey, how are you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true for you.
Yes.
Do you actually have a home in Dharamsala at the Dalai Lama's place?
No, I had an apartment over there.
Cool. Wow.
Yeah. In fact, if you look off the balcony, you'll see the top of the Dalai Lama's place where he lives.
Wow, in McLeod Ganj.
Yeah, I'm almost kind of the Dalai Lama's neighbor.
Wow, I've been there. That's spectacular. So,
right.
So you go there to hang out with him and to meditate?
Well, I used to spend a few months there and then back here. Now I go 2 weeks in the spring and I go 2 weeks in the fall. I always go to the teachings and listen to Dalai Lama. Of course, 7,000-8,000 some people roll in. You've been there.
Yeah.
You went for the science aspect, correct?
No, I went. They held this thing called the Synthesis Dialogues. They brought together 24 or 28 people that they thought were, you know, leaders in various fields, and we spent 5 days, 4 hours every afternoon. With His Holiness, just talking about these topics. It was fascinating.
Amazing.
Yeah, they made it into a movie that Harrison Ford narrates. It's called Dalai Lama Renaissance.
That's amazing. Yeah, in fact, Geshe-la Kalsang Damdul asked about you. You may not remember him, but he remembers you.
Oh, great.
He came over. Great. He's head of the Buddhist Dialectic Center there.
Are you a Buddhist now, Bob?
The other day. What's that?
Are you a Buddhist now?
No, but I could be.
Wow.
It's a nice.
Me too.
It's a nice way to live.
Me too. I agree. So let's talk about.
I'm not as serene to be a Buddhist, Tom. That's my problem.
Yeah, there you go. So let's talk about the news today, Bob. What's up?
Well, there's a lot of stories I know going on, you know, with the media day and everything with Trump. But one thing I wanted to kind of focus on was Rudy Giuliani, and you and I have, of course, talked about this since May when Giuliani, you know, around then when he came aboard. And I think everybody knew what he was building to. But I find this story of interest about the privilege, you know, it's called executive privilege, but it also, if you look in Wiki, it says, generally speaking, that presidents, the Congress, and the courts have historically tended to sidestep open confrontations, you know, step through them and over them and by them through compromise when it comes to executive privilege. And I actually had my case involved executive privilege of some things the government wanted that the House objected to. And in that case, we worked it out privately with the Department of Justice, you know, to satisfaction. I just wanted to mention that because what Rudy Giuliani did to have his cake and eat it too, for right now, Tom, is that he worked this out through conversations, you know, attempted, quote, with Mueller's team, through conversations about what they would or they wouldn't do when it came to obstruction of justice. Then he announced it. Because he said, I'm done, I'm not going to do it. So, you know, Mueller himself cannot come back and make public comments, you know, about negotiations. So Giuliani can do that. So, and now what he has done, he has laid this down very clearly yesterday, that they are not going to answer questions about obstruction of justice. It's not going to be part of it. And in fact, as you know, he has said, go ahead and subpoena the president if you want to. We will go to the Supreme Court.
So this is the line in the sand.
This is it. He's been building for this for a while because as people talk, it's kind of funny, I think humorous, to watch people talk about the legal skills of Rudy Giuliani. He was a former prosecutor, et cetera, et cetera. That has had nothing to do with President Trump. We've all talked about this on the inside in D.C. with friends.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with it, period. This was all designed with Giuliani, with the president's permission, to be able to take this to the court of public opinion and to put Mueller in boxes everywhere because, let's face it, if Mueller starts to come out and comment on this, he will have violated the the proper protocol of an investigation.
Right, so it's all about PR. So
this is PR. They're not going to have him sit down. He won't sit down. In a subpoena process, people talk, well, Kavanaugh would go with Trump. It doesn't matter. The process through the Supreme Court, as you know, I can't predict it, would be, you know, is it an emergency to the Supreme Court? Does it take 2 years, 3 years, four, five?
I think it could move really fast.
You think that they might make an expedited motion?
Yeah, I really do. I would be surprised if they didn't, but, you know, who knows? I mean,
it
this
would be agonizing if they didn't.
Yeah, I think they did in the case of Nixon, although the court may have been in session at that time, but I think not. I'm pretty sure it was right around this time of year, and the court ruled fairly quickly. But anyhow, what else is going on in the world, Bob?
Well, again, we were watching, you know, the reaction is up to, I think, what, 350-some newspapers now that have made comments, you know, concerning I think the president's statement, which probably threw them over the line, was when he called the press, you know, the enemy of the people. I think that's probably what actually...
And repeated it over and over again. Bob, back to the last topic, just real quick. When Andrew Jackson was told by the Supreme Court that he could not do the Trail of Tears, he said, John Marshall was the Chief Justice, he said, John Marshall's made his decision, let him enforce it. And then he went ahead and did the Trail of Tears. When the Supreme Court told Andrew Jackson that he couldn't shut down the Second National Bank of America, he said, I don't have to follow the Supreme Court, and he shut down the Second Bank of America. Mm-hmm. If Trump is ordered by the Supreme Court to testify before Mueller, and he says, no, I'm not going to go, There is no enforcement mechanism, as Alexander Hamilton pointed out in Federalist Number 79, as I recall. You know, the court has no power of the purse and no spear, was the phrase he used. No police department, no authority to enforce its own actions. That seems to me like the ultimate constitutional crisis. Do you have any sense how your former Republican colleagues might react if the Supreme Court ordered Trump to testify to Mueller and Trump refused?
I think that case right there, forget the rest, if he's on tape, he's lying, forget anything to do with that, right? I think if he would refuse and the Supreme Court speaks, I would believe that the pressure would be, intensity would be so great on them that the Republicans would have to begin, at least some of them, to express the word impeachment. I would have to believe that. And then once that happens, then one by one, the press would go after them to say, well, where do you stand on this? And let's just say, the Republicans keep the House, Tom, and 50 people go, or 40 for impeachment, there's a problem for the Republicans.
It's going to be the show to end all shows. And I think this is why Andrew Jackson's painting is hanging right next to the presidential desk in the Oval Office. Bob Ney, author of Sideswipe. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
You know, in the world of work, one of the most important things is one of the things that people probably think the least about until they have to sit in it, which is their chair. And the X chair is absolutely extraordinary. This is the new high-tech. In fact, they've got a brand new version. It's called the X3, the newest version of the X chair. It is comfortable. It is high-tech. And yes, I'll say it, it is sexy. This chair is extraordinary. And it will dramatically, consequentially improve your concentration and productivity because it's going to help your posture. And, you know, if you're not in pain and your blood is working, you know, flowing well, your brain is going to work well. The new X3 is quite simply the most modern, ergonomic, high-tech, comfortable office chair in the world, period. The X3's unique ATR fabric makes it feel like you're literally floating on air. And its patented split-back lumbar technology provides a cradling, customized feel that has to be experienced to believe. You need to see and feel the X3 for yourself. Go to xchairtom.com. That's xchairtom.com now to check out the X3's perfect blend of design and ergonomics. There's a lot of people, you know, checking these out and going for these chairs. Supplies are limited, so don't wait. Order at xchairtom.com. And if you do it now, you get $100 off. That's xchairtom.com. Or you can call them at 1-844-4-X-CHAIR. This chair comes with a 30-day, no-questions-asked guarantee of complete satisfaction. That's how good it is. Go to xchairtom.com. Right now, use the code TOM, T-H-O-M, to get a free footrest. xchairtom.com. Now back to the podcast. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. On the line with us, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Chief Prosecuting Attorney for the Hudson River Keeper, President of the Waterkeeper Alliance, author of several books, most recently Framed, Why Michael Skakel Spent Over a Decade in Prison for a Murder He Didn't Commit. His website, RobertFKennedyJr.com, and you can tweet him at Robert Kennedy Jr. Bobby, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom. How are you?
Yeah, I am fine, and I hope you are well and your family as well. This Monsanto thing just made my eyes bug out when I saw it. I was like, whoa, they took down Monsanto. Tell us about this decision where these people actually won a victory in a court of law saying that Monsanto was causing cancer.
Well, the background is that in 2015, the International Agency for Cancer Research, which is the premier gold ribbon agency that determines whether compounds are carcinogenic, met on glyphosate, which is the active ingredient of Roundup, which is the ubiquitous herbicide that Monsanto produces. And they made a determination that it is indeed a probable human carcinogen and a definite animal carcinogen. That finding triggered a number of regulatory changes, for example, Prop 65 in California, which is the labeling law in California, is connected to IARC, so that if IARC makes that determination, automatically that substance has to be listed in California stores and retail outlets as being carcinogenic, and a warning has to be attached to it. There's 18 other states that have similar relationships with IARC in many countries around the world. Monsanto challenged that in court and went to the California Supreme Court, and California won. At the same time, as a result of IARC's finding, thousands of people, specifically IARC found that Roundup causes non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and suspected of causing other cancers, including liver cancer, non-alcoholic fatty liver cancer. But we know that it causes non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So that triggered a cascade of lawsuits, and there's about five law firms that are signing up cases, and my firm is one of those. And altogether, there's between 4,000 and 5,000 cases signed up. My firm has about 800. The first case of all of those to be tried and reach a jury was the case of a school groundskeeper, a 42-year-old African-American whose name is Dwayne Johnson, who is dying of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that attacked his skin. Oh, he's in a lot of agony, and he's had a very, very tough time, and he was a fantastic witness. We pushed that case to the front of the group because he only has, at most, the doctors say, a year to live, and we wanted to try the case while he was still alive. And the jury in that case, despite real headwinds from the judge, this case was tried in San Francisco Superior Court, California Superior Court in San Francisco. The judge excluded a lot of evidence, probably about 80% of our evidence against Monsanto on the liability issue, ultimately did not make it to the jury. And we were, I think, fairly pessimistic in this case just because the jury was not allowed to see our best evidence. In fact, we weren't even allowed to mention GMOs or Prop 65. And nevertheless, jury came back with really an historic and extraordinary verdict, which is altogether it's about $40 million in compensatory damages and $250 million in punitive damages. Bayer, which is the German company, the big chemical firm, big chemical multinational, which used to be called IG Farben, which owns Monsanto.
They dropped that name after the Zyklon gas that they manufactured was being used to kill people during World War II in the camps, isn't that right?
Right. It was used in Auschwitz, and they made huge profits on Zyklon B.
Yeah.
It was a killer investment for them. And
pun intended.
And the six of their top executives were convicted of slavery and a number of other crimes, and one of those became the head of the new company, Bayer, in 1955. One of the executives had been convicted, and there's been just a bad culture of kind of elastic ethics at Bayer. So it was a good match for Monsanto. They swallowed Monsanto for $60 billion in June. But they really swallowed a poison pill because this is the first of 5,000 cases. There's a lot of them in California who are going to be in front of California judges who are going to be much more inclined to let the jury see all the evidence than this particular judge. And, you know, I think Monsanto really is in trouble now.
Yeah. Fascinating. This is all about non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and possibly other cancers. And wow,
we were restricted only to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But as you know, Tom, there's a lot of other health impacts that are associated with Monsanto. One of the problems is, Monsanto was in trouble really because of overreaching. For many years, Monsanto has become the premier herbicide on Earth through, manipulation of growing two businesses at once, its GMO business, which made Roundup Ready crops like soybean, wheat, corn, and other ones. And those crops are resistant to the herbicide, to Roundup. So you can literally saturate the landscape with this herbicide. It kills everything it touches except those crops. And those crops then will grow without competition. So that's very attractive. And that had been its business model. In 2014, Monsanto developed an off-label use for Roundup. It began going to farmers and saying, not only are we good for weed control, which you spray at the beginning of the growing season so it doesn't ever get on the food, but also you should spray us at the very end of growing season, at the harvest, because it turns out that Roundup acts as a desiccant. It dries out the crop and makes it much easier to remove it from the field. They began spraying Roundup on food, literally on the food before it's eaten.
I'm wondering if I can line up the timelines here, Bobby. Back in 2001, I developed, in quotes, celiac disease. If I eat anything with wheat in it, I am. It's like having a severe case of food poisoning.
And there's a really strong evidence that the epidemic of celiac disease is coming from the Roundup. Worse, because they're literally now spraying it on the food, and it's now been found in children's cereals, it's in oatmeal, it's in granola, it's in virtually all children's cereals, it's in our food, it's in vaccines, it's in our water, it's in plants and animals and mother's breast milk. So it is ubiquitous, it's everywhere. So there's a lot of science now going on, and the science is saying, look, this stuff is probably responsible for the epidemic in alcoholic fatty liver disease, which we're seeing for the first time in kids. 10-year-old kids are getting this.
Wow.
It used to be a disease that only affected very old people. It also is a chelator, so it removes metals from your body and minerals, valuable minerals, and it causes these really dangerous imbalances in copper levels in human beings. It's an endocrine disruptor. It destroys the microbiome in the human's gut, and that causes brain inflammation. And so there's a whole constellation of these illnesses that are associated with exposures to glyphosate, and the ubiquitous nature now of glyphosate means that a lot of people are experiencing these illnesses.
That's amazing. So we're talking with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the chief prosecuting attorney for the Hudson Riverkeeper, president of the Waterkeeper Alliance, author of several books, and the guy who took Monsanto to court and won. Bobby, where do we go with this? Do you expect that we see at some point less Roundup in our biosphere and I'll be able to eat wheat again? I mean, you know, is that coming down the road?
You know, I think it is going to come, despite the virtual takeover of our country of corporate money that makes it kind of impervious to anything that doesn't contribute to corporate profit-taking. I think the European countries, which still have something left of their democracies, are all looking at banning glyphosate or not relicensing it. And I think the science is cascading, Tom, right now in a way that's going to make consumers revolt against it.
Good news and remarkable news. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Bobby, you are extraordinary. I got to tell you, you are absolutely one of my heroes. Thank you so much for dropping by our program today and for picking up this case.
Thanks, Tom. That's
great.
Why you're my hero.
Thank you. Back at you. Bobby Kennedy Jr., his most recent book, Framed. On the line with us, our old buddy, Professor Richard Wolff, the economist, co-founder of Democracy at Work, author most recently of Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, essays on the global economic meltdown, his website, democracyatwork.info, and rdwolff with two Fs, .com. And you can tweet him at Prof. Wolff, Prof. Wolff.
Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for joining us today. The country of Turkey is in some considerable turmoil right now, and Donald Trump raising steel and aluminum tariffs, specifically on Turkish-made steel and aluminum, as well as other goods from Turkey. This pastor in Turkey, who has been imprisoned as a member of Mike Pence's church or religion, and Mike Pence is quite upset about it, and so Donald Trump is doing this mano a mano with President Erdogan of Turkey. There's this concern that it rattled not only the Turkish economy, and I'm sure you have the details on that, but also the emerging markets in general, other countries that are similar to Turkey in economic structure. How did this happen? How is it that a country like Turkey could be responsible for bringing down the entire global economic order, or at least, you know, making things wobble pretty badly?
Well, the answer to that is in the core economics of the situation. The reason Turkey frightens so many people, and rightly so, is that the story of Turkey is likewise, in a way that I'll explain in a moment, the story of many other countries, South Africa, Indonesia, Colombia, in other words, all over the world, the so-called emerging markets. Many of them have a situation so close to what's going on in Turkey that it would be bizarre not to be worried about the quote-unquote contagion of the Turkish situation. So here in a nutshell is what happened. When global capitalism crashed in 2008, a decision was made in the United States, in Western Europe, and elsewhere to handle it by what we call trickle-down economics, basically to pump money into the banks that had failed, into the stock market that had crashed, basically handing it to the people who brought us the crisis, the folks at the top of the economic pyramid, and hoping that what they would do would trickle down eventually and help everybody else. Lowering interest rates so that the United States Federal Reserve and central banks around the world dropped interest rates to record lows at, or in some cases, below zero. At this point, every capitalist in Turkey who had any plan to do anything realized that he or she could borrow money virtually costlessly in New York or London or Paris or Berlin and use it to fund whatever risky investment he had had his eye on. And indeed, one of the biggest ones was building luxury housing in the middle of Istanbul and things like that for the rich, who are the only ones who can afford this thing. And for a short time, roughly from 2008 to now, a decade if you like, it created a kind of mini boom in Turkey as all of this money from abroad flooded in, bidding up the price of land, of housing, helping some companies to grow. And you had these laudatory stories about how wonderful Turkey was as an emerging economy. And just like the United States in the 1980s and 90s, nobody paid attention to the simple fact that it was all dependent on borrowed money. Not only borrowed money, but money borrowed at a very low interest rate to fund very risky investments. And true to form, because this has happened in capitalism more times than I can count on this program, it only took a little while, less than 10 years, for the risky investments to start not paying off on the one side, and for interest rates to rise because the Federal Reserve and other central banks, having overpumped money into the economy, now are pulling it out by raising interest rates, and the poor Turkish capitalists who made the risky borrowing and who made the risky investments are caught in the middle. They can't afford the higher interest rates, and the investments they made were too many, too enthusiastic, too glowingly expecting the boom to last. You know what it's like? It's like the mini boom in the United States right now that flowed from the tax cuts of last December. It won't last very long. It's leading people to borrow again in the United States. The long-term prospects of being able to pay it back are poor. And so what Turkey does is force the world that pays attention to recognize the shaky foundations of the situation economically right now and to worry themselves sick, as well they should, as to how many other countries are right behind Turkey waiting to unload on us the collapse. And by the way, little footnote, Turkey borrowed all that money in dollars and in euros. As the Turkish lira collapses in value, and it's lost nearly half its value in the last 6 months, it is, of course, impossible for the Turks to pay back those loans since they have to give way more lira to get a unit of the currency they borrowed in. And since that's true for Indonesia and for Colombia and for South Africa, it is a disaster waiting to unfold. And the latest word from Turkey, which is that they're going to try to contain the situation by cutting government spending 10 to 30%. That's what the Minister of Finance in Turkey said earlier today. That means that the pain of all of this is going to be loaded on to the average Turkish citizen in a literal collapse of public services. This is a disaster.
You didn't mention tariffs. The tariffs don't play a major role in this? Is that just the media doesn't know what it's doing?
No. They're interesting because it's just another example of Mr. Trump violating all the old Republican dogma that the government should not intervene in the economy, that the market works best if it's left alone, the traditional laissez-faire business. He's ignoring all of that. He's interfering. But this is symbolic. As you rightly said at the beginning, this is to placate his fundamentalist base by being a champion of a minister held over there because the Turks accused the minister of engaging in espionage. I have no way of knowing the right or wrong of this. But yes, the tariffs are just public relations activities, not just by Mr. Trump, but by Mr. Erdogan in response. The amount of trade between Turkey and the United States isn't all that big, and it will not be all that affected. And these underlying problems of the net external debt that Turkey has are infinitely larger than anything that will be affected by these tariffs and these maneuvers of the two leaders to look strong to their two constituencies.
So the precipitating event or the inciting incident was not the raising of the tariffs, it was the raising of interest rates by the Fed? Or did the raising of tariffs cause people to go, and start paying attention to the debt in Turkey, and that then brought about, you know, a withdrawal from Turkey's markets?
No, in my perspective, the real crisis was that Turkish capitalists borrowed way more money than they should have in foreign currencies and invested it in projects that couldn't, if you take them all together, possibly be profitable for all of them. In the typical capitalist investment boom, when money suddenly becomes really cheap, that was going to blow up on Turkey, with or without a tariff war, with or without trade troubles. That's not a sustainable model. Much of that borrowing was what we call short term, that it's a year or less that it'll come due, and they used it to finance real estate projects, which take years to pay off. Borrowing short-term, investing long-term is a kind of no-no that you teach students in the first year of a finance course. And so it's a capitalism working its way in the underdeveloped world, not so differently from the developed, but in an unsustainable process which has now been exposed and added to by the little dealings on the tariffs. But those are more political theater than they are basic to what's going on.
Professor Wolf, in the last minute or so, minute and a half that we have here, the New York Times, William Cohen published a piece in the New York Times a few days ago, the headline, "The Big Dangerous Bubble in Corporate Debt." He notes the domestic debt market is at $41 trillion for the domestic bond market alone. And the debt market, he says, is broadcasting a dangerous message. Investors desperate for debt instruments that pay high interest have been overpaying for riskier and riskier obligations, and that this is spread among university endowments, pension funds, mutual funds, and hedge funds, and that all of this might go down. Is this essentially the same thing as what happened in Turkey? American capitalists are doing the same thing. They just haven't been caught yet?
Exactly. That's why it is so frightening. You know, you look at Turkey and you have to, given the debt, because the same logic applied. The interest rates went to next to zero, and American corporations said, oh, goody, we can get money for next to nothing, and we can fund everything. And in the early years of that, the fact that everybody's doing it makes everyone think that the rationale for them having done it is working out and that they will make the big profits that they're hoping for. But when you put it all together, the lack of a planning system, the lack of coordination, means you're going to have a capitalist boom for a few years, followed by a capitalist bust. It's been the pattern for the 300 years we've had capitalism. And yes, Turkey is the canary in the mine. It is the situation that makes everybody, like Mr. Cohen in the New York Times, begin to recognize that this is not a problem limited to Turkey. They may have gone a bit further than others, so they're the first one to go bust. But the danger of the overhang of debt, of the borrowing that the federal government has done in the United States, that consumers have done, and that the corporate sector has done, raises the awful possibility that when these things turn down, the ramifications, the multiplier effect, will be the credit that collapses, and then the whole system begins to crumble.
Wow. Professor Richard Wolff, the website's democracyatwork.info, rdwolff.com, and you can tweet him at Prof. Wolff. Professor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Me too. I always learn from you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Larry in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Hey, thanks for taking the call. You know, I've probably employed, you know, a lot of people became self-employed back in 1990 in small business and Seattle area, Tacoma. For me to insure one of my guys, you're talking about $500 a month for one of my guys.
I know, same here.
The programs that are available. So you were saying that pre-existing condition, that whole thing, like, oh my God, it's so bad. But Tom, look, if you're under the age of 30, like my kid works for me, he's 25 years old, okay? I would have to pay $500 to $600 a month to insure him. He's got no problems. Why can't he have a major medical plan, you know, like we used to have?
Because it blows a hole in the side of Obamacare. If you don't have young, healthy people paying into a system that is being used by older, unhealthy people, then the older, unhealthy people are going to have to pay so much that you don't have a system anymore.
You've never ran a small business then, my friend, because there's no way.
Larry, you don't know what you're talking about. The simple reality, it's like saying, you know, only people who are retired should have to pay into Social Security. That's essentially what you're saying, Larry. And frankly, respectfully, it's stupid. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's been a fascinating day. I've been saying that a lot lately, but it has been. I mean, it's an amazing time to be alive with everything that's going on. I got to track down what Omarosa's tape was. I'm guessing we'll be talking about that tomorrow. And continue with more of the news of the day. Tomorrow will be Anything Goes Friday, so, you know, whatever's on your schedule, whatever you'd like to discuss, give us a shout. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy doesn't just happen by itself. It's not some magical thing that, you know, Thomas Jefferson dropped on our heads. It requires you. Every one of us have to get active all the time. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.